A very happy new year and welcome to the January 2023 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspapers monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor and Fran Frank joins me this month to co-anchor the programme. Well, 2022 was quite an eventful year, wasn't it, Fran?
Yes, it certainly made up for the lack of notable events from the previous 2 years. On 10th of January, there was the first successful heart transplant from a pig to a human patient in Baltimore, United States. 16th of January saw tennis champion Novak Djokovic detained in Australia for not having had his COVID-19 vaccination and was then prevented from participating in the Australian Tennis Open.
It was officially Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee on the 6th of February. On that date, she became the first British monarch to celebrate 70 years on the throne.
In February, Russia invaded Ukraine, although Putin still claims it is a military exercise, thus commencing a war which is still going on. As a result of this action, there has been a marked rise in energy and food prices in the United Kingdom and Europe, with repercussions across the world. The weekend of 2nd to the 5th of June marked Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee celebrations in the United Kingdom.
On 18th July, Draupadi Murmu was elected as President of India, making her the first tribal woman and youngest person to be elected to the office. On 31st July, England won the UEFA Women's Euro 2022, their first major tournament since 1966.
Here in Britain, railway workers held several strikes throughout the year. Postal workers went on strike, as did barristers over legal aid funding. Dock workers at Felixstowe, plus several other ports around the country, also went on strike, followed later in the year by nurses in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, ambulance workers and border force staff. There were major protests in Iran following the arrest and subsequent death of a young woman in police custody. She had been arrested for not covering her head properly with a veil.
We had three prime ministers in the space of just 2 months. On 7th July, Boris Johnson announced his resignation as Prime Minister. Liz Truss was appointed PM on 6th September and then announced her resignation on 20th October, making her 45-day reign as UK Prime Minister the shortest in history. Then on 25th October, Rishi Sunak became the first British Prime Minister of colour and, at the age of 42, the country's youngest leader in over 200 years.
8th of September was a very sad day for the United Kingdom and the rest of the world when it was announced that Queen Elizabeth II had died. Prince Charles succeeded her as King Charles III. The Queen's state funeral took place on the 19th of September.
On 28th October, Elon Musk purchased the social media platform Twitter for $44 million. On 15th November, the world population reached 8 billion.
On 18th of December, Argentina won the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. 25th of December saw King Charles III make his first Christmas broadcast as monarch.
Many notable people died as well. The American actor Sidney Poitier died on 6th January at the age of 94. India's famous playback singer Lata Mangeshkar died on 6th February at the age of 92.
Former Australian cricketer Shane Warne died on 4th of March at the age of 52. American politician Madeleine Albright died on 23rd of March at the age of 84.
Former Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, was assassinated on 8th July. Northern Irish politician David Trimble died on 25th July at the age of 77.
British-Australian singer and actress Olivia Newton-John died on 8th of August at the age of 73. The final leader of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, died on the 30th of August at the age of 91.
Legendary Brazilian footballer Pelé died on 29th December at the age of 82. Pope Benedict XVI died on 31st December at the age of 95.
Well, having taken you back through last year's notable events, let's have a look at what we have in store for you in this month's roundabout. Jenny Jenkins recently met up with professional musician Alan Graham, and we will be sharing their conversation with you.
Fran will be sharing some amusing articles from the Canine Chronicle. Stephen Taylor and Mary McDonald will be discussing the book they have read recently.
Aileen Clarkson will be sharing her letter from a dog walker. Lorraine Ferguson will be reading Chapter 3 of her friend Jilly Pugsley's diary of their trip to Iceland.
Valerie Forrester has another frog joke for you. John Townsend is back with Part 2 of his interview with trombonist Peter Smith. Part 1 of this interview appeared in the November roundabout.
There will also be a couple of pieces of music in the programme for added entertainment. We start off with Jenny and her guest.
Hello. Today, for those of you who remember television programmes such as Lunchbox, Play School and Top of the Pops, my guest today is a professional musician, Alan Graham. He's appeared mainly playing percussion on many TV shows and also touring with the likes of Tom Jones and Shirley Bassey. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Jenny.
I'd like to take you right back to your beginnings. I believe you were born in Cornwall and then you were brought up in Dawlish, so tell me more about that.
Yes, I was born in North Tamerton, which is near Bude. 1927, ooh, so a little bit older than you, Jenny.
And then when did you move to Dawlish?
Yeah, moved to Dawlish, and my father opened a grocery shop, Walsingham's Piermont Stores, Piermont Place.
I believe growing up in Dawlish was a very busy time for you as a lad, with church choir and Cub Scouts, and also you had to help your parents with the deliveries, didn't you?
Yes, I used the trade bike, so-called, with the basket on the front, delivering the groceries locally for my father and trying pushing it more than I rode it, probably.
Sounds like another television story I'm thinking of. I understand that your mother, Stella Walsingham, was a talented pianist and singer who became involved with the local Amdram group there.
That's right, yes, she played piano and sang soprano and was involved in all the local musical comedy shows.
And where were they performed?
They were performed in the little theatre called The Hut, which is at the back of the gardens at the top end of the town. That's where all the local theatre shows took place.
Wonderful. Tell me a little bit more about your father, Percy Walsingham.
Well, he'd done a little bit of comedy in his younger days, so he had the idea that because of the entertainment situation in Dawlish, it'd be an ideal place for a concert party, a seaside concert party. So he started the local show, The Bohemians.
Oh, that sounds very, very 1930s.
It was.
I believe he worked with another famous man called Jack Train there, wasn't he?
Yes, he worked with him during the First World War, so he knew quite a bit about comedy, and he was quite a good comic and singer, my father, so he was the ideal person to start this up.
Jack Train was on Itmar, wasn't he?
That's right. Oh. Itmar, and years later, when I was about 14, I was very privileged because I worked for a local theatre school. I was in the film of Itmar at about 14 years old.
Ooh, fame at last. Oh, well, we're getting on. I got you to about 5 or 6 and then you decided your father wanted to involve you with one of the shows. And yes. How did that start?
He did sketches and one was called The Shopwalker when the cast pretended to be customers. I came on as a little 5-year-old lad with a jam jar and said I'd like 2 pennyworth of treacle. And he said, yes, sir. The treacle department, just a moment, came back on with the jar and said, "There's your treacle, where's the tuppence?" And I would say, "In the bottom of the jar."
A good start for you. I think you moved to Riviera Terrace, and then because of your father's work, the family moved to Sussex. 1939, and the war started. What did you actually do? Because a big step in your life came.
I got into East Grinstead Grammar School, and I was about 11, of course. And then my father got a trio, the three Grahams, together to entertain the troops and the local people during the war.
But didn't you go to a local stage school?
Yes.
Down there and learned to tap dance?
Went to a little school. No, that was later on when we moved up to Sutton in Surrey. Mm. And I joined the Sylvia Bryant Stage School and I learned to tap dance. And, of course, compare the shows in the local parks and whatever and entertaining the troops with my father.
Before D-Day.
Mm. Before D-Day.
1945, you were old enough to join the army. Where did you end up?
Yes, I started in Scotland for my primary training, but ended up at the Military College of Science in Swindon and became a clerk, really, but started to play a bit of music, as I didn't play any instrument at all, the vibraphone, because a friend of mine played bass and he had a vibraphone, so I started to learn the vibraphone.
Wonderful. What a fortunate meeting that was, because did you not form a jazz group?
Yes, and I went from there to play in London. After I came out of the army in 1948, I started up playing in the jazz clubs in London and then ended up with Ralph Sharon, who was the top small band at the time, and then left Ralph Sharon to join Jerry Allen and become a member of the Jerry Allen Trio and did a variety act with him.
Wow. Did you get demobbed at that time?
After I got demobbed.
That was after
1948.
Yeah.
And so that's when I started my musical career as a full-time professional musician playing jazz in London.
In the Soho Jazz Clubs.
What
a start. So you're now a fully-fledged professional musician and you joined the Jerry Allen Trio then. And what sort of work did you do with them?
Well, I joined Jerry because he wanted to reform his variety act. So we started doing variety theatres as a variety act when singers were top of the bill. Mm. And a summer show at Felixstowe, which is when we were fortunate to get an invitation to play on the Benny Hill television show. Oh. And from that, Benny Hill offered us a variety tour with his touring show for 8 weeks.
Oh.
And very fortunately on that show, one of the dancers met me and Dulcie, and she became the Mrs. Alan Graham.
Oh, I say. Well, that was romantic. When it became the television Benny Hill show, was she one of the girls he used to trace through the trees at the end of the programme?
Well, we went on to Blackpool with the variety shows. And then we got invited to do a show called Lunchbox. Dulcie came with me to start Lunchbox, which was a daily television show from Birmingham. And that lasted 8 years.
Goodness me. Did you have other television shows as well coming along?
Yes, as well as doing Lunchbox at the time, which was a daytime show, we were doing 64,000 Question and Dotto at the weekends for ATV. Rainbow Room with Roy Castle was a guest on that quite often. And the Carol Levis Show, which was a talent show at the time.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yes. So you left Birmingham and came to London.
When Lunchbox finished, I went back to London, and became a freelance percussion player. I learnt to play all the percussion, timpani, xylophone, bells, effects. Gosh. And, of course, went into the session world, fortunately, and became a session player in London and was fortunate to get Play School as one of my engagements. A session percussion player then was doing Crackerjack, Basil Brush.
Top of the Pops.
Top of the Pops, of course, as an extra when required.
And the BBC Radio Orchestra.
And the BBC Radio Orchestra, which I did a lot of sessions. And, of course, all the other musical directors that came in to take the orchestra.
Well, I know that on top of all this, you were also doing a couple of West End shows, Applause and Barnardo's.
Yep. Wait. And also, yeah. I was doing sessions during the day and the evening performances in the West End, but that became too heavy, so I was able to make a living just doing sessions and dance band music, of course.
Well, what a full time it was for you. And there's Dulcie at home, you've got three children, and she's doing her own
dancing. We lived in Oxfordshire. She was a dancing teacher and ladies keep fit teacher, bringing the children, and I was doing work for the local musical scene.
Well, I want to ask you now, what do you consider were the highlights of your varied career?
Touring with Tom Jones, Shirley Bassey, and my favourite was Perry Como, and I did four tours with Howard Keel, which was wonderful.
And Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yes.
I'm not going to hide your light under a bushel. Barry White.
Yes.
Frankie
Gladys
Lane.
Gladys Knight. Charlie Rich.
So, we've got a quiet minute or two, you can tell me all about them. Now your career has come to a little end, but you're still been doing a lot of teaching in Oxfordshire. You had your own big band and charity concerts, and your students went on following in your profession.
Yes, I'm very fortunate. I taught in Oxford for 15 years. Several of my students over the years have gone into the profession in the Strictly Dance Band under David Arch, who I also taught. There are three musicians I've taught, and several have gone into the military, and of course I've been very fortunate to have that to follow on my career.
Well, time, of course, has run out, and I have to ask you one more thing before we say au revoir to our listener. Can you select a piece of music and tell me why you've chosen this one in particular?
It would be very hard to pick one tune because I've played on so many recording dates, but I would choose Tom Jones's Help Yourself.
Well, you certainly have helped yourself. And thank you, Alan, very much for sharing us your memories. And it's been an absolute pleasure.
So memories of Dawlish.
Memories of Dawlish, indeed. So from a 95-year-old gigging professional musician, thank you very much. And for our listeners, bye-bye.
Thank you, Jenny. Bye-bye.
Love is like candy on a shelf. You want to taste and help yourself. The sweetest things are there for you. Help yourself, take a few. That's what I want you to do. We're always told repeatedly, the very best in life is free. And if you want to prove it's true, baby, I'm telling you, this is what you should do. Just help yourself to my lips, to my arms. Just say the word and they are yours. Just help yourself to the love in my heart. Your smile has opened up the door. The greatest wealth that exists in the world could never buy. Just help yourself to my lips, to my arms, and then let's really start to live.
All right.
Yeah. My heart has love enough for two. More than enough for me and you. I'm rich with love, a millionaire. I've so much, it's unfair. Why don't you take a share? Just help yourself to my lips, to my arms. Just say the word and they're yours. Just help yourself to the love in my heart, your smile has opened up the door. The greatest wealth that exists in the world.
never buy what I can give. So help yourself to my lips, to my arms, and then let's really start to live. Just help yourself to my lips, to my arms, just say the word.
That song was Help Yourself by Tom Jones. It's now over to you, Fran.
Although I normally work with the blue team in reporting news items from the local newspaper, I thought you might enjoy the following articles I found in an American-based publication produced for other members of the community. The first item relates to a fashion hound seeking damages. Julie Jack Russell is upset. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there, she explains. Her spring fashion line was recently photographed for Vogue on an exceptionally large Doberman, and the lines were ruined, she howled. My line is for petites only. The whole thing made me sick as a dog. And the nice little picture of Julie wearing a bobble hat and a stripy pullover. The next item. Fifi's gone sniffing. Fifi Le Poodle, new line of perfume, is wafting across the nation. After Le Poodle last aromatic disaster, her fans are doing a full body wag. Designed to mimic the aroma of her favourite culinary treats, the new fragrances are mouth-wateringly scrumptious. Introducing her innovative delivery system, Fifi sells her scents on a new and very fashionable line of collars. Each collar is the line delivers a different appetite-pleasing aroma. The collars are reusable, and she offers refill packs sold separately. While the fashion possibilities are endless, scientists are also paying some attention. Fifi's collars may have some effect as an appetite suppressant. Wouldn't that be the dog's bow wow? So far, cheese popcorn and fish sticks are the best sellers. The next item, something to bark at, and there's a picture of a dog kennel. Yes, folks, it's true. Low-cost housing will soon be available in a yard near you. Rising bone prices and lower salaries have made the building of affordable housing a necessity. Check your local fire hydrants for postings. Smaller breeds are looking for roommates. Construction begins this fall, and the waiting list is growing by leaps and bounds, so start your begging now. Sizes may vary according to breed, and no barking rules may apply. Some assembly also necessary. And last but not least, something from the sports pages, entitled Member of the Audience Disrupts Sports Event. Rosie Cocker, a local spaniel, who is a member of the Working Breeds Agility Team, interrupted a recent gathering at the sports arena here in town. After the incident, Rosie was interviewed by a local journalist. All I saw was an athlete throwing a long stick, and I just went for it. As it was stuck out of the ground at a rakish angle, I grabbed the handle and ran back. On the way, I noticed another individual spinning around and hurling a flattish object way out into the field. I immediately changed direction and raced over to recover the frisbee. How was I to know they were javelins and discus? Rosie's coach and owner was very proud of her and said, "It was probably the best fetch and retrieve she's done in months. It may even qualify her for the Doggy Olympics next year." I hope you enjoyed some of the articles, which came from an alternative publication called The Canine Chronicle. Bye!
Stephen and Mary have been reading Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro and are here to review it. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook.
This month, Mary and I have been reading a novel, quite a recent novel. It's called Clara and the Sun, and it's by Kazuo Ishiguro, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature a few years ago. This one is a little bit science fiction-y. It's set in the near future, I suppose, within the next 10 years or so, I think. And it's in America. And it's all written from the perspective of a robot, artificially intelligent, human-made robot. And the book is all from her point of view. And this is what makes it original and I think makes it quite interesting.
Very, very interesting. Quite moving. I was pre-warned that it's a bit sci-fi, which is fine. I'm quite into a bit of sci-fi. But I found it very warm story. At the end, it hits you a little bit about what you've actually read and what you've taken under your arm, so to speak, of what it's all about. I was a little bit slow getting into it. I became very conscious that it was artificial friend, which they were talking about, AFs in a shop window, and not an original idea because we know all about AI. We've seen television programs. We've lots of stories about them, and it starts years ago. I mean, I've read sci-fi for years and years and years under the influence of my late father, of course. But this is different. This is looking at the AI that we almost fear. Clara sits in her shop window and takes everything in. And one of the fears about AI is its learning power. And Clara certainly does. But also Clara has faith. Clara has faith in the sun's energy because she's solar powered. All these things come to you slowly and gently as you read. But it's so real. She becomes so real.
Exactly. So this is not a real person. This is a machine. She goes to stay with a family and then they grow up. The children grow up. The child grows up. And so she's left without a role. And it is incredibly sad.
It is.
And yet this is a machine. Yet you see the whole thing from her perspective and you root for her.
Absolutely. But also the inevitability of our life is sown into her life. There is an acceptance that life ends, whether it's human or a machine. But also there's all these other characters she watches, and she's exceptional, I think, in the fact that when she's in the shop, her manager, the shop manager, realizes that she's exceptional, that she does watch and learn and take note, and also that she is there for the reason of becoming the best friend of a child. A child in a world where genetic engineering has taken place, which can damage the health of the children. But all this unfolds as you're going along. You don't get it straight away. It unfolds in the story as you're reading, as you're listening, as you're learning about these people in the story.
And she's, of course, the ultimate unreliable narrator. So she is very naive about the world. She thinks the sun goes to sleep in a barn because she sees it going down into the barn and so on. So she's bright. She's really very intelligent robot, but she's not educated. And she's having to learn about the world, learn about relationships and love and so on, and parents and children. And all of this she has to pick up. And she does. And she's learning all the time. And that becomes part of the story too.
But one of the odd things about the learning is that she also has to learn about suspicion, a sense of not goodness in people. But don't let's say that she has a vision of the sun. That's her faith. And remember that a lot of the people of the world have that faith. The sun rises in the morning, gives you life, gives us everything, and sets in the evening. And Clara's faith is in that. She has so much faith that she puts her child, her friend, to get the benefit of that son, the power that she gets. It's marvellous. I loved it. Can't you tell?
Yeah, no, I think it's brilliant. I think just as a literary achievement, actually, to be able to sustain a story of this length, 300 or 400 pages, and make it so gripping and so obviously beautifully written, but to keep you completely engaged when it's written, you know, from the perspective of a machine.
Absolutely.
It's quite extraordinary.
We now have Aileen with her letter from a dog walker.
Dear listener, today the house looks so bare without Christmas decorations. My hall, dining room and sitting room were decorated as usual, even though I spent Christmas Day with friends. January always seems a little empty after all the wonderful build-up to Christmas and New Year. Nonetheless, I still have Honey Bear to walk daily. She's sitting beside me, looking extremely bored. So far today, it has been impossible to go for our usual long walk. Rain has fallen continuously. Reluctantly, she's briefly visited the garden and returned to be enveloped in a towel to be dried. She rather likes being rubbed dry and even offers her paws in rotation to have them dried too. I have checked the website, which provides minute-by-minute weather forecasting, and it has predicted a dry spell between 6:30 and 7:30. So we plan to drive to Tynmouth, paws crossed. Well, this we did, and we were rewarded with a relatively dry hour. We parked near Finn McCool's fish and chip shop, where I ordered fish and chips to be collected in 35 minutes, which gave Honey Bear and I plenty of time to walk around the town, visit the den and nearby memorial bench for my sister and husband, and we even had time to stand still to listen to a very noisy sea. The fish and chips were most enjoyable, and I have to admit that Honey Bear had some as well. Already, the first few days of the year have begun to merge into one. However, by noting on the fridge calendar where Honey Bear and I have walked, I can recall the cold, windy walk in Dawlish Country Park on the morning of New Year's Day, or our walk in leaf-covered mud through Oakland's woods, and another on the beach, when we both got a little too close to an incoming wave and went home with 6 wet feet. There are lots of good reasons to share my life with a dog, and at the moment the obvious benefit is that we keep one another warm. In the evening we snuggle up together under a rug in the sitting room to watch television. Honey Bear does not object. In fact, she cannot wait to get covered up and go to sleep. I worry that she has become too much my constant companion, but separation is difficult when it is just the two of us in the house. My one resolution is that Honey Bear should spend a day every so often with Sarah, the dogminder, to give her more independence. Did you make any resolutions for this new year? I used to make lots, and invariably they were forgotten or ignored. For Christmas, a friend gave me a brilliant gift, a bowl filled with all I need to grow 7 miniature irises. The soil came in the form of a compact cake, which needed to be activated by adding about a cupful of water. The cake swelled as if by magic into enough soil to fill the bowl. I planted the small bulbs, and now they're in the fridge drawer for the next 10 weeks. Once removed, they should flower after 3 weeks on a sunny windowsill. I will keep you posted. Honeybear received the gift of 2 spiky new balls, one neon green and the other bright orange. About the size of a tennis ball, both were covered in soft spikes, which make them easier for Honeybear to pick up and drier for me to handle. She very quickly removed the squeak from both, which was a relief because the noise was piercing. I recovered both squeaks and threw them away. The balls differ only in colour, but the green one is Honeybear's favourite. She carries it around from room to room in the hope that she might tempt me to have a game. The orange ball is in the basket with all the other out-of-favour toys. Honey and I send to you our wishes that you have a wonderful 2023, a whole new year to make memories. We try to do something different every day, however trivial, even if it is just crossing the road and using the pavement on the other side. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
Let's find out what Lorraine and her friend Gilly got up to in Iceland.
Two Blondes and a Spoon Do Iceland by Gilly Pugsley. Chapter 3. A Whale of a Time. You can never be sure what the time is in Iceland, as it changes quite randomly and without notice. It's something to do with the configuration of the international date line and magnetic due north when Venus is out of alignment with Mars, as anyone who has studied these things will tell you, or something. Anyway, we think we awoke at 6 a.m. on our second morning, but can't be sure. After a time check with various watches and mobiles, we decided it was 7 a.m. Icelandic time. Probably. After breakfast, we set off in the gloom in search of another authentic Icelandic restaurant for our evening meal. We had passed a likely candidate on our first day and thought perhaps we could find it again. Unfortunately, Reykjavik had moved. As those of you who understand these matters will know, Iceland has a habit of sort of spinning on its orbital axis, quite randomly and without notice. This does make finding places difficult and, if you're blonde, confusingly irritating. Try as we may, and even with such an accomplished and experienced map-waller as Lorraine, we found ourselves walking in circles against the current through deserted streets and past dark shops in the early pre-dawn light. Eventually, we did stumble across the restaurant, but it was quite accidental. The mapmaller made extensive notes on one of her by now growing collection of maps and convincingly reassured me we would be eating here tonight. Hurrah! On the way back, we looked in some very expensive clothes shops with fabulous shoes, art shops and the usual rubbish tourist shops. Hardly any people, and only a spattering of tourists were on the streets. There was very little traffic, too. And what cars were on the roads stopped immediately to allow you to cross. A slight show of toenail off the curb seems to give you priority. Nearing the hotel, we walked down an alleyway to a pottery boutique Lorraine had wanted to inspect. As we approached, the snooty-looking owner
promptly turned the open sign to closed and exited to the back of the shop. We pressed our noses to the glass and blew him a kiss. We'll attempt entry another day. Probably. Back in our room, we have an hour before departure on the whaling mission. Kellerer, the massive clock on the massive church over the way, chimes 11 times. My watch sort of states 10. The hanging watch on my bag says 11, but that is proper English time, so it must be 10. The mechanics of the massive clock must be wrong. Lorraine heads for the landing to check the massive clock face, but sitting reading in the window is an American lady who has just arrived and is waiting for her room to be cleaned. Lorraine has to lean precariously over her in a contorted fashion. The big hand is on the 12, the small points to 11. Whose hands, I inquire, thinking perhaps Lorraine's assaulted the American. The clock's, you fool, snorts Lorraine. I feel a little foolish, or just blonde. I'm still not convinced, though, so I have to check for myself, and I execute my own balletic manoeuvre over the American. I wouldn't take any notice of the church clock, I tell the American. It's an hour fast. It has to be to compensate. It's something to do with the configuration of the international dateline and magnetic due north when Venus is out of alignment with Mars, you know, or something. Lorraine checks with her mobile on which 12 means 11 in Reykjavik. I hope you're keeping up with this. Then I suddenly remember I've altered my hanging watch to correct Icelandic time. There's much hilarity at this, and we both reach for the tenor ladies. There's no time for snoozing. We're off to the Haitian cafe for quiche and scowls. It's freezing cold as we board the boat, but as we've donned our thermals, we elect to sit on the top deck. The boat steadily fills, mainly with Brits. We're just about to weigh anchor and hoist the mainsail when two Japanese ladies appear running along the quay, attempting to leap on board. Maybe they just haven't spotted the gangplank. The captain hoists them bodily aboard. The crew all cheer to a man. They collapse exhausted into the seats next to number 13. They appear to be mother and daughter. Mother promptly recovers from her exertions and takes a J-cloth from her backpack and starts cleaning our table. She smiles and gestures for us to stand while she wipes our seats. The daughter, who is sitting next to Lorraine, rummages amongst her backpack. She produces a packet of dried fish and starts chomping noisily. The aroma is horrific. We're off! A whale watching we will go. I like this life on the ocean wave, me. Lorraine's practicing a nifty little hornpipe. I'm brushing up on me sea shanties for later. And we take to the northern bow. The onboard guide tells us of the different types of whales we are likely to see and the signs to look out for. We are to shout, "Avast there!" if we spot a gushing blowhole, suspicious-looking black triangle, or Captain Ahab. The sea is very choppy, the scenery volcanic. The mountains are covered in snow, and Reykjavik soon becomes a mere dot on the horizon. Even the massive broken church clock. After 2.5 hours on rough seas, our expectations begin to dim. Not a sausage, let alone a whale. We're bloody freezing and decide to take to the brig, where a handsome, well-oiled Viking is behind the bar, dishing out hot chocolate laced with rum. Oh, army hearties! We indulge gratefully and spend the rest of the cruise here, joined by the rest of the whale watchers, the crew, Roger the cabin boy, and the captain. The Japanese ladies have been sleeping soundly for the last 3 hours, rhythmically snoring in unison. So, amid the stench, the waft of double-deckers, and a glimpse of hope, we head back. Deep down, I know there was a whale deep down, but he was having a laugh and thinking, Wednesday must be the tourists. We disembark, a little disappointed, but invigorated by the trip, and head for the supermarket for more Sprite and crisps to compensate. It's still cold in the bedroom, and we sit in our beds wearing thermals, gloves and hats, reading, snoozing, and dreaming of whales. At 6:45, it's pre-prandials. 3 double gins, 2 double chins, olives and crisps. We party on down until 7:30 when Matt Waller guides us to the restaurant. Number 13 is mightily impressed. He spent his entire life in restaurants and is a bit of a connoisseur. This one's brightly lit and crowded with locals. We both opt for the Icelandic platter. Minke whale, traditional Icelandic fish stew, dried fish and garlic roasted lobster, washed down with Icelandic gin and lime. It's mouth-wateringly fabulous. And we may not have seen any of the elusive whale, but together we damn nearly polished off one for dinner. We managed to find the hotel at about 10 or 11, or maybe it's 12, depending on whose dateline you believe. Coffee in bed and hit the sack. End of a perfect day. Hurrah! To be continued.
Hello, this is Valerie with another frog joke. A man walks into a bar, buys a pint, then says to the barman, "Look at this." He pulls a frog out of his pocket and a tiny piano. The frog settles down at the piano and bangs out a perfect performance of Rachmaninoff's Third. The barman is amazed, but the man reaches into his other pocket. "That's nothing," he says, pulling out another frog, which he puts next to the first. This new frog breaks into a gorgeous rendition of O Sole Mio, accompanied immaculately by the pianist Frog. Another man comes up. "Tell you what," he says, "I'll put money behind this bar to keep you in drink for the rest of the night if you'll give me that singing frog." The first man shrugs and agrees and hands it over. As the new owner leaves, the barman says, "Are you mad? You could have made a fortune with that singing frog." "Not really," says the man. "The pianist is a ventriloquist."
We now have John Townsend with part 2 of his interview with Peter Smith.
This is part 2 of my conversation with Peter Smith, the trombonist who's travelled all around the British Isles playing for, well, various bands and orchestras, Peter, and I think you've done quite a lot of television work from sort of the 60s onwards.
Yes, indeed.
I think Pebble Mill, some of our listeners may remember, yes, programmes from there that you were involved with.
That's right. Pebble Mill had the Midland Light Orchestra. We also had an orchestra called the Orchestra de Camera, which was more classical music. And then, of course, we had a 12-piece brass group, and we were called Gemini Brass. We had the most fabulous drummer called Norman Parker, and we were doing a recording of La 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 and we're doing this recording, and it was going quite well, and we got to the tea interval halfway through the recording, and we're in the Pebble Mill having coffee, and the conductor saw Norman Parker, our percussionist, said, "Is there any way you can make the sound of the lake, you know, can you conjure up something?" Anyway, we all returned into the studio and we started playing, and all of a sudden this sound came from behind us, which was wonderful. But when we turned around to look, what Norman had done, he'd got himself a bucket of water, a pipe and a beer mug, and all he was doing was blowing into the water and piling the water up from about 2 foot in the air. Wow. And the noise was just perfect.
Yeah.
But every time we tried to put the recording on to play, one of us would collapse, and it was so difficult that we had to cancel that session, because the conductor, because he was as bad,
yes,
you know, and we just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So that one was abandoned.
I guess that must be a big problem with playing with a bunch of pals. If
absolutely.
One of these stars,
it really is infectious.
Yeah.
You know, it's things like that. And I remember fondly when our second trombone player, Graham Lacey, we were playing in the Birmingham Town Hall, and every Thursday night in the orchestra you were in tails.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all getting ready. There wasn't much time between the end of the rehearsal and the performance, and suddenly Graham said, "Oh no!" And we said, "What's the matter, Graham?" He said, "I've forgotten my black shoes." And he had these big Doc Martens brown boots on. And so Gordon, the first trombone, said, "Have you got your black socks?" He said, "Of course I've got my black socks." He said, "Well, look, come here." And what we did, we stretched the black socks over the brown boots. And with the bottom of his trousers, it just covered the tops of the boots. But then he was 6'2". He had a very rosy face. And he was a very handsome, very tall man. And as we walked on, you've got to walk onto wooden floor. And then you've got to climb up these wooden steps to go to the back of the orchestra.
Mm.
Well, he was mincing along because he dared take a stride, and so he was almost on his tiptoes going to the back of the orchestra. And of course, that was a moment when you had to be very careful about laughing during the play.
I would think so. I guess when you play serious pieces, you know.
Well, you can't. But you see, with violins, if they start giggling, it just improves their vibrato. But you try laughing whilst blowing a trombone.
Wow.
So it was very, very difficult.
Yes. Is it true what they say about sucking a lemon in front of a trombone player?
Do you know, John, this must be the 100th time people have asked me, and I must Google it, because it's never affected me, but it has been in the annals of comments, hasn't it, that they'll suck a lemon in
so front. Has anyone ever tried it?
Well, no, I don't think they have.
Well,
they can try it.
We'll try it later. Well, look, basically you're saying you played really all styles of music, from big orchestra, orchestral sounds, and I think you played in opera, and you played...
Ballet,
yes.
Ice shows.
And jazz, do you do jazz?
No, big band jazz.
Big band jazz.
Sometimes I played in, you may have known the Sid Lawrence Orchestra.
All right, yeah.
They're the Glenn Miller type music.
Yeah, yeah.
But I only went as a deputy. I was never permanently with a big band. I am here in North Devon, we've got one here, but generally speaking it was out of my comfort zone, really.
Yeah.
Because one day I was playing with them and I hadn't rehearsed, and it was, you know, and I suddenly realised that the other three trombones were stood up. It was a little feature.
But
by the time, as an orchestral player, by the time I'd sorted myself out, I got up and they'd sat down. It was like a yo-yo. Because they had the music
very
stand.
Very entertaining, I'm sure.
They had the music stand down here, lower down, and we have ours up in the air. So it was a difficult one.
What fun. Now, you've obviously played in various brass band competitions. And
I did my first one, in Birmingham. To help me to get onto the bass trombone in a major way, my teacher in the old days, John, the bass trombone had a handle on it to get the extension of sound, and it was called a G trombone, G. And it was called in the army bands the kid shifter, because it was always on the left by the pavement, and push your slide down and move the kids over, you're getting in your way. So it was called the kid shifter. So my teacher put me onto the G trombone for about 18 months. And I was so lucky because they were going to do a recording of Elgar's Firth Symphony. And the conductor, by this time, by the way, everybody was on the big B-flat and F bass trombones, very small, very powerful. And he wanted to do a performance of Elgar's Firth Symphony, which was scored, of course, for the alto tenor and the G trombone, not the B-flat F and the big one. And he asked me to do that particular performance. So I was very proud to be able to do that. And then what he did for me, he changed me then to a B-flat F and E. But whilst on the G trombone, I played with, in Birmingham, I played with the John Thompson Works Band, which was sponsored by the Boilermakers. It's a big factory. And I enjoyed it. I mean, it did me a power of good. And so that was...
all good experience. I mean, from the sublime to the ridiculous. You've done some lots of fun stuff and TV work, I think.
Yes.
I think you told me earlier you worked with Les Dawson.
Yes, indeed. Yes, he was a wonderful man to work with.
Yeah.
He'd always come into the green room on a Thursday, before the Thursday performance. He used to come in with a little carton of little cans of lager, and we all had a little can of lager. We weren't drinking heavily, and he'd swap stories. You know, he'd ask us about stories, and he'd built on communications and people's habits and things like that. And it was really very good.
And I think you said Tommy Cooper.
A wonderful man. Some people ask me, John, before I peg it, what I would want to play, and it would be Elgar.
Yes.
And it would be the Dream of Grotius.
Yes.
Elgar with a large choir. And that's my favourite genre of music.
So you have played that?
Oh, many times. So I remember doing that in Malvern.
Yes.
A big concert performance.
In the Winter Gardens.
In the Winter Gardens. Yes. And it was live, a big audience on a very hot afternoon. And at the end of the first half of Grotius, he's singing to the Lord. And he's singing, take me away. Well, if he sings it once, he sings it half a dozen eight times. And at that moment, a lovely lady, three rows back, fainted.
Oh.
And the men came from the back. And we carried on playing. And they carried her, because they couldn't get across. They carried her out while he's singing, take me away. It was the most extraordinary experience.
I'm sure it was. For both the lady and Peter Beard.
Yes. May I suggest something? Yes. I've learned one lesson in life, and that is timekeeping. Because I just joined the union, I got my first engagement in the Three Choirs Festival, and it was the Orchestra de Camera, and I set off, and I arrived in Hereford, then read my contract. It was Gloucester. And in those days, in the 60s, you try driving quickly from Hereford to Gloucester, and I was really panic-stricken.
Yes.
Anyway, I got there 20 minutes late, but all the orchestra were on the grounds outside, all chatting. So I acted all suave, as if I'd just... Yeah. And what had happened, the wedding before the rehearsal in the afternoon had gone on half an hour longer. Now, that taught me, John... I've never been late since. I got such a fright.
Yeah,
imagine your first gig. And,
yes, of course.
Yes, that was...
Well, there you are. There's a lesson to us all.
Yes, indeed,
so,
yes.
I think on that note, we ought to pause again. We'll perhaps come back for our final programme shortly.
Wonderful. Thank you, John, very much.
And here is our final piece of music entitled As Time Goes By, sung by Vera Lynn. Did you know that it is 80 years since the release of the movie Casablanca?
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say, I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, man must have his mate. That no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by. Fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
Our thanks go to Jenny Jenkins and her guest Alan Graham, Fran Frank, Stephen Taylor, Mary MacDonald, Aileen Clarkson, Lorraine Ferguson, Valerie Forrester and John Townsend.
Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor.
From Fran and me,
goodbye.